Amina is an activist during the Arab Spring. Her blog, Gay Girl in Damascus, attracts readers from around the world. When she's mysteriously abducted, her followers mobilize, desperate to save her. What they find shocks them. I'm Samira Moyeddin, the host of Gay Girl Gone, a new 6-part series from CBC. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
Hey there, I'm Rosemary Barton.
And I'm Alameen Abdul-Mahmoud.
And this is Party Lines.
There are calls for Canada to boycott or move the Winter Olympics out of Beijing next year, with the conservative leader Aaron O'Toole saying that the government of China is engaged in a genocide of its Uyghur population. So what should Canada be doing here? And how does this country's attempts to secure the release of the two Michaels actually factor into all of this?
There's another question that's been buzzing around here and will continue to until it actually happens. As we wait for vaccines, lots more arriving this week. Is there a better time to have an election? Should it be this spring? Should it be this fall? How are parties calculating all of that?
Lots to talk about, so let's get into it.
Let's do it.
Are you a big Olympics person, Rosie? Do you watch the Olympics? Do you make like a ceremony out of watching the first day and maybe like some of the big competitions that Canada's in?
I can't say that I am, Elamine. I mean, you know, you watch the stories if they become news stories, because sometimes that
yes.
happens. I watch them sort of through a news lens. But no, it is not. I don't just abandon my life and settle in and watch every event. No. And you?
I try to, you know, I don't. I try to tell myself that, like, I'm not an Olympics person. But then when the Olympics roll around, I, like, whenever they're on TV, I'm like, let me just sit down for a minute and watch the rest of this bobsled event. Like, I did something about a sporting event that is on all day. They're just kind of like, yeah, I'm in this. And I enjoy watching the spectacle of it. And honestly, like, I found myself kind of missing it last year because we were supposed to have an Olympics last year in Japan. And then they've been moved to this year because of the virus. But anyway, that is not what we're talking about, because we're actually talking about the Winter Olympics of 2022, supposed to take place in Beijing. And as we record this, there are loud calls to boycott or move those games out of China, of course, over China's reported treatment of its Uyghur minorities. And just to give a quick background to that, the Uyghurs in China are reportedly facing mass sterilization. They're facing forced labor camps, sexual assault, an intense and wildly advanced surveillance state. Aaron O'Toole, the leader of the Conservative Party, has called it a genocide. The United States, just last month, the State Department called China's treatment of the Uyghurs a genocide. In November, our parliamentary subcommittee said China's policy against the Uyghurs amounts to a genocide.
Right.
But it is not the official position of Canada.
No.
The Prime Minister did take a question on this, and here he is.
On determinations of genocide, the principles of international law and the international community in general, I think rightly, takes very, very seriously the label of genocide and needs to ensure that when it is used, it is clearly and properly justified and demonstrated so as not to weaken the application of genocide in situations in the past. And that's why it's a word that is extremely loaded and is certainly something that we should be looking at.
Canada in particular has you know, further issues at stake because we have two Canadians, Michael Kovrig and Michael Spavor, who have been detained for more than 2 years, who have been detained on essentially trumped up charges. You know, this adds to China's tendency to arbitrarily detain people, to say nothing of their questionable practice of human rights. And that's why Canada is even more directly impacted by this and may have to consider this in a different way than other nations as well.
We should say, like, these calls to boycott or move those games are not new, but this week we've seen quite a bit of movement when it comes to these calls. We heard Green Party leader Annamie Paul and NDP leader Jagmeet Singh, Conservative leader Aaron O'Toole, they've all publicly denounced the fact that China will be hosting the Olympics at all. And we saw Singh and I think Paul both suggest that they be moved to Canada. maybe be hosted by Canada and the United States together. And it is worth mentioning that the first MP I saw talking about this at all was conservative Michael Chong, who suggested this as early as the fall of 2020. So it's been in the conversation for quite some time. And I should say that almost every Olympics, there are calls to boycott. This came up before during the Winter Olympics in Russia in 2014, of course, because of Russia's long list of abuses against its LGBTQ citizens. And, like, there are a bunch of questions I want to get into. How significant is it that three opposition parties have all kind of rallied around the same position? I think that's really interesting. But I think the first basic question to ask is, like, are boycotts any good? Like, do they actually get the point across at all?
Yeah, like, I think if you think about, I'm just going to try and think of something that I've boycotted in terms of a product. I can't even think of one. But, like, if you can throw the weight of the economy and consumers behind a boycott of a product, it sort of becomes an interesting version of cancel culture in some ways, right? And it can have an impact, and it can force a company to to sort of change its perspective or to go bankrupt, as the case may be. I'm not sure that you can say the same thing about world geopolitics. Like, I don't know that you can have a couple of countries or many countries decide that they're going to not participate in the Olympics and expect the impact to be the same. And here's a couple of reasons why. First of all, it's not actually countries that send Olympians to the Olympics. It's actually Olympic committees that decide to participate. And those are supposed to be sort of arm's length from the government, funded very much by governments, but sort of independently making their own decisions. So Canada would have a hard time saying we're going to boycott. They would have to compel the Olympic Committee to do that, and they would have to convince Olympians that this was important. I think the other concern would be, is this symbolic, or does it have any impact for China, right? Like, if it's just a couple of countries not going, do the Olympics go ahead anyway? If Canada doesn't show up, does it matter at all? Would anyone even notice? I mean, those are some of the things that first come to mind for me.
I have to say that there's been quite a bit of noise about how boycotts are not effective in the sense that, well, if the event is going to happen anyway, what does it really do? And the biggest example that people refer to is the 1980 Olympics. And that is when Jimmy Carter in the United States got a bunch of other countries, including Canada, to boycott the Olympics taking place in the Soviet Union because of its invasion of Afghanistan. It's worth mentioning that that boycott happened in 1980. It's the height of the Cold War, so the boycott itself can't be divorced from all of those geopolitical dynamics and anti-communism. So here's the Canadian government talking about this, saying, hey, we're not going to those Olympics.
We have decided that the circumstances leave us no choice but to urge the Canadian Olympic Association to inform the organizing committee for the 1980 Olympics that Canadian athletes will not be participating in the Games. We ask Canadian athletes and Canadians generally to support this important decision which has been taken in the national interest. International terrorism in all its manifestations, whether by armed students or disciplined troops, is unacceptable to Canada.
That was the then External Affairs Minister, Mark McGuigan, speaking in the House of Commons in 1980, talking about why Canada will boycott those games. The idea that such a boycott would have worked, that the Soviet Union would have seen all these countries boycotting the Olympics and said, I guess we got to get out of Afghanistan, was always absurd. Like, that was never going to happen. But I do think it's significant in the sense that that those boycotts were very popular, especially in the U.S. Like, more than half the population supported the boycott. Mm-hmm. It got more people talking about the reasons that they're boycotting the Olympics. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, they did their job in that they rallied a country around an idea. And I think that is significant and not to be dismissed.
Yeah, 66 countries ended up boycotting those Olympics. And so probably the magnitude of it was significant. Of course, history always looks at things differently. And now that decision is seen to have been potentially the wrong one, at least from the athletes' perspective, who missed out on this. And I think that's the part that is maybe harder for me to understand anyway, because I'm not an Olympic athlete, definitely not.
Yes.
And that is that, you know, sport is supposed to be, particularly at the Olympic level, sort of above politics, not getting mired in questions of politics, and actually is there to help unify the world. I mean, I know that sounds cheesy, but that's sort of what the Olympics mm-hmm. are, right? To celebrate
yes.
sport and the human ability to do remarkable things. So for it to become political, I think for many athletes is problematic. At the same time, though, this idea that, you know, sport is bigger and more powerful and devoid of politics. I mean, it's not true in plenty of places like the NBA, which has had taken a powerful stance on Black Lives Matter. It's also not true at the Olympics. Not only was there that 1980 boycott, there was also in 1984, 14 countries, including the Soviet Union, who responded to the previous boycott by not showing up. There have been other examples. 1988, North Korea and Cuba boycotted the games. And who can forget probably the most powerful example of politics being used at a time when people are focused, the world is focused on a stage. And that's in 1968 when two African-American athletes, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, got on their podiums and raised their black gloved hands in a symbol of black power to talk about civil rights. And I mean, everything about that was political and it was hugely important. Mm-hmm. So while athletes and while the International Olympic Committee would like these to not be caught up in politics, they are, of course, you know, riddled with it and have become important symbols for all sorts of political movements through the years.
I guess, like, my question becomes, it may be a hard image to stomach, the idea of Canadian athletes wearing the Canadian flag at that opening ceremony in China and just kind of participating in the celebratory air. But at the same time, do we really expect athletic bodies to do what instruments of the state won't do, which mm-hmm. is to say, like, completely shut out China and take a hard stance on China? Because it's not like we're stopping trade with China. It's not like we're sort of taking all these hard positions everywhere else on China and we're just not doing it through sport. It's like all these institutions are not taking that hard position. So why should we expect the Olympic Committee to?
Yeah. And would it be more powerful to do other things? Would it be more powerful for Canada to say officially that there is a genocide happening within China and the way they are treating the Uyghurs? Would it be more powerful for Canadian athletes to go there and to wear a T-shirt that says something or take a stance on an issue or use every opportunity in an interview to talk about human rights issues within China? Maybe. Like, maybe those things would have a bigger impact on China and the world's view of China. But I think you're right. I think the notion that suddenly sport is going to become more powerful than all the things that we are not doing is pretty hard to understand.
Throughout the 1980s, a strange phenomenon was sweeping North America.
They were in a panic, and like people in a panic, they want solutions.
Allegations of underground satanic cults torturing and terrorizing children. The thing is, there were no satanic cults preying on children. And nearly 30 years later, the people touched by it all are still picking up the pieces.
This isn't a work of fiction. This is a work of history.
Satanic Panic, available now.
As we record this podcast, there are more than 400,000 doses of Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine making their way to Canada. They were slightly delayed on Tuesday because of weird winter weather in the United States, but they're making their way here, and then they're going to make their way to the provinces, and then they're going to start getting into arms, and vaccines are going to ramp up. I mean, we're moving now quickly into bigger and bigger numbers, and soon the general population and max vaccinations, and That's all good. That's all good stuff.
It is.
Yeah. But it does sort of beg the question about whether there is an opportunity or a window here for an election sooner or later, and how, you know, more vaccines could influence that decision. I think we saw over the weekend what happens when you have an unexpected outbreak of COVID, in particular one of the variants, which is what we saw in Newfoundland and Labrador, who, you know, very confidently called an election. It was going to be the fourth province to hold an election during a pandemic after BC, Saskatchewan, and New Brunswick. And given that they had virtually no cases, they thought, well, here we go. This is going to be fine. As it turns out, the variant that originated in the UK made its way onto the island, and numbers started to go up. And it became clear very quickly that, you know, having a bunch of people show up in person to vote wasn't the best idea.
yes.
And poll workers were quitting. And anyway, they've had to now make it a strictly mail-in ballots. And the deadline for getting your ballots in now in Newfoundland and Labrador is moved to March 5th. But there was certainly a lesson there for politicians federally watching that situation. You know, a microcosm of what could happen if things started to go wrong. And if you just started to, you know, be really, really unlucky in your political timing. I don't know how you think that might color a federal election.
Well, so at the same time that all of this is happening and these vaccines are arriving, there's also this new polling that has arrived. And I'm starved for new polling. I'm so interested in it because what we've been seeing as a dynamic generally across the country is that, generally speaking, incumbents are doing pretty well.
Yeah.
That's why you can imagine an election was called in Newfoundland. But this polling from Léger revealed that Liberals are 10 points ahead of the Bloc in Quebec. That is an incredible lead. A couple of weeks ago, Innovative Research and Angus Reid had the Liberals up more than 10 points ahead of the Conservatives in Ontario. Mm. That is also an incredible lead. Overall, the Liberals have about a 5 to 6 point lead over the Conservatives, nationally speaking, depending on which poll you look at. And if you're looking at these numbers, you're saying, okay, we are double digits ahead in the two most populous provinces in the country. It must be near impossible for the government to restrain themselves from pulling the trigger right now. Because, like, those are the numbers that you want to see. And, like, if the government's internal numbers, and they almost certainly have different internal numbers that they base their judgments on, if their internal numbers are showing a gap that's this big, it must be very, very hard to resist pulling the trigger to have an election, because those are very favorable numbers. Those are like near majority territory numbers. But at the same time, some of that polling also showed that the federal government is wearing the vaccine rollout problem. So, you know, you have this sort of slowdown in the vaccines for a couple of weeks. We didn't get any. And there is this sort of question mark as to whether it's going to be the federal government that wears these problems mm-hmm. or the provincial governments that do. As it turns out, the polling suggests that the federal government is seen as widely more to blame. And this is like, vaccines are the issue. So if the opposition can't get traction on vaccines, what the hell can they get traction on? Like, at this, like, what can they do to move the numbers down for the Liberals? Because it's like, Canadians are saying, look, we do blame the Liberal government for this vaccine rollout problem. But at the same time, also, we are giving them a lead nationally. So it's like, this must be ripe for the picking for the Liberal government, don't you think?
Yeah, I mean, everyone that I talk to, every Liberal that I talk to says, you know, COVID is our first priority. Vaccinating Canadians is our focus. And we want to govern. We want to govern. We want to govern. So I think what becomes the question is, when does it look like governing is becoming more difficult for them? And that could happen by opposition parties not supporting a budget when it finally comes. It could happen by the government giving itself, you know, a mandate for an economic recovery that seems to be impeded in a minority parliament, and so it believes that it needs a new agenda, a new chance to show Canadians that they have the right plan. I think they're faced with, as you say, like these vaccines finally coming, the provinces hopefully knowing how to get people inoculated. And the reality that, do you actually want a bunch of Canadians at polling stations voting during a pandemic, even though Elections mm-hmm. Canada has a vastly different plan than Newfoundland and Labrador and is way more focused on mail-in ballots? Do you want Canadians having to think about that at a time when they are either waiting for a vaccine, or someone in their family is waiting to be vaccinated, or, you know, they're still worried about their workplaces? Like, all those things are still going to be at play in the spring. We're not all going to be, you know, vaccinated in April and May.
Yeah.
So is there an opportunity there for the opposition parties to say, okay, this isn't going well, or it's not happening fast enough, so we will be the ones who will wear the idea that Canadians have to be at the polls amidst a pandemic? Or do they all say, let's wait until the fall when everybody's vaccinated? But the problem with that is certainly more opportunity for the opposition parties. Everyone feels more comfortable with an election. But now we're into the space where there is a real serious post-mortem analysis of how the government responded. And yeah. we're in a place where the economy probably hasn't recovered yet. And suddenly the Liberals have to find a way to rebuild the economy and sell Canadians on their plan, as opposed to everybody else fighting for that same terrain. So you can see how, like, it's not clear what the best moment is for anybody here. And that's, I think that's what we've got to keep our eye on. There's no perfect spot for any of them, really.
There is conceivably a window of time between now and the fall where enough Canadians are vaccinated,
yep.
but the Liberals are still talking about how successful the vaccine rollout is.
Right.
And we're not yet onto the question of how will we get out of this economically. Where the Liberals can say, look, we're handling this so well, let us continue handling it so well.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're right. I think, like, when we get to the fall, the questions inevitably become different. I think there is such a strong appetite politically, and not just for this, whenever the next election is, but just in general in terms of, like, our political ethos. Most elections are not, hey, what have you been doing for the past few months? They're mostly, like, what are you going to do now? Like, mm-hmm, how are we going to get to the next point in our future? That tends to be the question that people ask. And parties do get punished if they spend too much time being like, look what we did in the past few months. But there is a window of time for the Liberals to seize that, so that, like, they could write a very narrow story somewhere maybe between, like, May and June, where, like, you get to live in the middle. You're saying, okay, mass vaccinations have been happening for a couple of months now. People are enjoying the success of that. And that is, I imagine, what the opposition parties are trying to control for. They're trying to sort of prevent that window of time from being all, look at all these successes of the government.
You know what that is? That's
what
me.
Is it?
That's me toasting myself for the haircut I'm going to go get right after this podcast.
Oh, I'm so happy for you, but also so livid.
No, like, you're not actually even happy for me. I know you.
Yeah, I'm just livid. You're right. I was trying to do the polite thing, but I'm livid. I'm furious.
Listen, I'm on TV. Everyone's going to win when I get my haircut. That's also the sound of Last Call, of course. It's where we ask you your take on an issue. Last week we asked, do you feel comfortable with loosening public health restrictions where you live?
One person wrote in to say, I don't even know what I'm comfortable with anymore, which, like, same.
Yeah.
They added, I just want to be able to have my friends over for dinner and browse in a bookstore. Oh, that sounds like the dream. I would also like that. And someone suggested, we shut down last year when so much was unknown. Opening up now with what we know and don't know about new variants would be gross negligence.
Interesting. Okay, so this week we want to ask you about the first topic we were chatting about, the Olympics. Should Canada participate in the 2022 Olympics in China? Tweet us your thoughts on that. I'm at Rosie Barton.
And I'm at Elamine88. Please throw in the hashtag. The hashtag is Party Lines, and let us know what you think.
And that is it for Party Lines this week from CBC News and CBC Podcasts. I'm Rosemary Barton, chief political correspondent for CBC News.
And I'm Elamine Abdul Mahmoud, who does not have a haircut. I'm a culture writer for BuzzFeed News.
And really bitter about my hair appointment.
Facts. It's true.
See you back here next week.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.